The culmination of 29 Australian happiness surveys over 12 years. 29 surveys. The culmination of this analysis by Melbourne's Deakin University has revealed if you live within a golden triangle, you are more likely to be happy. And the golden triangle that you need to live within consists of a loving partner, $100,000 of household income, and a social activity that offers a sense of purpose, gentlemen. My question to you is, how golden is your triangle?
Well, I'm very much so, John. I fit into this category 100%.
My question
really
is...
Although the amount of money, that could be an issue.
Yeah, 24 carat for me, without doubt.
Of course, far away from the golden triangle of happiness is the axis of misery, which presumably consists of a poorly paid job and a slovenly, purposeless habits and a hectoring spouse. I don't know. But, I mean, is this just common sense?
Well, it was interesting to note that of the three, it talks about a meaningful social activity, not a meaningful job.
No, that's correct.
So that you could, in theory, within this context, have the most hideous 9-to-5 grind every single day. But if you've got something that lights your fire at the weekend.
Yes.
If you're volunteering or donating or something at the weekend, then that could actually cancel out the drudgery of your dreadful job.
Yes, and other people have agreed with you. Clive James's famous comment that happiness is a byproduct of absorption in something worthwhile.
Well, yeah. Over history, if you look at back over 100 years, most jobs were in that category.
Yeah.
It's only today that more people are indulging in jobs that are also their hobbies. Like mine,
yeah,
to some extent.
Or alternatively, you've got people who are doing jobs that create nothing for the universe, I don't know, foreign currency trader, for example, just to pick one at random.
Oh, but that's a mathematical thing and make deals. But then your day ends and you can go off in your yacht.
But what have you created at the end of the day?
It's no different from any other weird dealing.
Do you agree with Deakin University too? And you've probably heard this before. They say that life really does get better with age. So the elderly, if they have no bad or chronic conditions like severe arthritis, are actually happier, and happiness tends to rise beyond the age of 55 or 60. The professor who was explaining the results wasn't quite sure why that is, whether it's because the kids have left home or they've left the dreadful job.
It does oddly contradict something that we've actually talked about in this very studio in the past. The idea that when people are interviewed as they're dying and they're asked, what age would you go back to? What was your best age? I don't know if you remember, Jim or Neville, but routinely the answer is in your 30s. That's what many, many dying people look back on as being their golden years.
Would you go back to your 30s?
My 30s, you know, they had their moments, definitely, yeah.
Okay, they were quite cool. You wouldn't go back to age 18?
Oh, dear Lord, no.
I think the answer to that question, Jim, is that as your children grow up and they're less dependent on you, you're also wanting to rest a bit more, have a bit more leisure, and that must be something to do with it, because young couples these days have to be pretty fit and don't get as much sleep as they'd like.
Mm. People on the rich list are only slightly happier than the rest of us.
That surprised me. That what happens to people who earn more than $100,000 is the misery index cut in again.
They'll only be happy if they give it away, Neville.
Only when there's a dispute over a marriage breaking up and all that sort of thing, that creates a lot of misery.
Yeah. I would like to volunteer.
Losing all your money in an bad investment's another one.
Yes.
I'll volunteer to make that my community social benefit thing. Anyone who feels the need to bring themselves down to 100,000 a year, I would be delighted to take it from you to I'll shoulder that burden for you.
That's a very generous gesture. Some might say a royal gesture.
One does one's best for one's people. Incidentally, this $100,000, is this Australian or New Zealand dollars?
Yeah, it's Australian dollars. But let's say it's 110 or 120.
Okay, we need to make sure. There's probably some people listening to this going, I'm not quite sure if I'm happy or not. I'm getting the calculator out. They've just probably figured out whether or not they're happy.
It's basically the money, obviously, that you need to get by and pay the school fees and clothe the children and have a holiday a year, etc.
I'm sorry, I thought we established last time we said we don't pay school fees.
Sorry, yes, that's right. Refuse to pay the school fees.
Absolutely.
And have two holidays each year.
It's twice the amount of a pension, so that should make people think.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. What about the chess clubs, though?
What about the chess clubs?
They're not very social.
Pass?
It says here. not very good because they're not very socially interactive.
Oh, you mean if you were choosing a social
rather than say bridge, I guess.
Oh, I missed that bit of it. Okay, so you choose a social. Yeah, okay. You just don't sit down at a chessboard with one other person. If you're really good, though, Neville, there's a crowd around you, so that would be quite social. It's 22 to 5, and Steve McCabe's with Neville Gibson on the panel. Steve, what would you like to mention?
Well, I would like to mention, referring back to something I was talking about earlier, I've had the interesting experience of going through several aspects of the New Zealand Health Service just recently. Most recently, this very morning, having this thing taken out of the side of my head. And this is following on from having been through the American Health Service over the course of the 2000s and gone through the Japanese one in the 1990s. I don't even remember the British anymore. It's far too long in my past. As I said, I'm getting old. I think part of it's losing the memory.
The accent stayed, though.
Oh, absolutely. So, well, one has to retain one's royal bearing, don't you know? But what I would like to say very simply is, you know, back in the United States, there is this huge sort of knee-jerk reaction against the idea of social medicine. It's wrong, it's socialist, it's un-American, and it has to be a user-pays system. It has to have a profit-generating stratum in the middle between the, not even the patient, but the consumer and the customer at the one end, and the provider at the other. There has to be a profit-stripping middle layer. In this country, that doesn't exist. And as a result, the care that we get in this country and the service that we get from health professionals, in my experience so far, without exception, is very, very different, and it's vastly superior. And in case there are any Kiwis listening to this who don't quite realise how superb the system is here, I would like to point out that, in my opinion, it is head and shoulders over what I've experienced over the last two decades, and I'm very fortunate to have access to it.
All right, that's a nice shout-out. There are the tentative beginnings of a profit-stripping middle layer in New Zealand out there with all the specialists doing both hospital work and private practice. We're not...
Well, but that's true, that there is the private sector, if you choose to go into it. But for any citizen or resident of New Zealand, there is the publicly funded sector, which is available to all. And I think that's one of the hallmarks of a civilised first world society. And I don't really know how American can call it self-civilised, as long as it doesn't have that.
Yeah, but most wealthy New Zealanders would be taking the health insurance and paying the maximum and ensuring they get the Rolls-Royce service. Though,
and that's absolutely fine. As long as they wish to do that and are making the choice to do that themselves, they are absolutely welcome to do it. But regardless of that, there is still a provision made for every New Zealander to have good health care regardless of ability to pay. And that's a good thing.
Helen Clark must have got a shock when she went to America because, of course, she said you don't need private medical insurance in New Zealand, but she would need it over there.
Oh, dear Lord, yes, you do. The procedure I had done today, I was charged $150 for. If I took the time to price it up on the internet. Actually, to be fair, my wife took the time to price it up on the internet, and she told me. And we came up with a figure of somewhere in the order of starting around $2,000 and going and counting up from that. And that's because you're paying not just to your doctor, but you're paying through to service providers who want to take their cut out of that. There's a whole layer of other things going on. I'll take New Zealand any day.
Just to give some balance to your happiness discussion, says Lindsay plaintively, I have no job, no partner, no money, life not getting better at age 63. I'd be happy to have someone surplus too, says Lindsay. Neville, what's on your mind?
Well, I was reading in The Spectator at the weekend, an interesting column which covered a number of issues, a lot of them are ones we know about, global warming, Syria, British membership of the EU. Here we'd probably put David Bain issue in that category, gay marriage. All of these are issues where there's a lot of people, and I'm thinking about these people, who have the not sure position. And they usually listen to a very persuasive argument on one side and maybe another on the other and agree with both. And in the end, you end up not agreeing with either. And because the zealots on both sides of these arguments usually turn people off fairly quickly. So there's a whole new political class. Now, I don't know whether these people, like they did at the by-election at the weekend, just say, well, I'm not going to go and vote, which is more than what half of them did, or whether this becomes a new Peter Dunn-type party of common sense.
How would you form a don't know party or a sitting on the fence party?
Don't know party, yes. It just struck me because you said if you went to a dinner party and you mentioned certain topics, you don't want those topics to come up, do you?
Yeah.
School trips is one, apparently. Syria would be another one.
At a dinner party? Nobody would mind talking about Syria, would they? Oh, maybe you're right.
Depends who the guests are.
I've been told before I go to certain dinner parties, there are certain topics you don't talk about.
All right. Syria being one of them.
Possibly. Okay. Yeah, I can't remember that, but global warming might be one.
Yeah.
But to be fair, a lot of these polls tend to take a very, very nuanced and very, very rich and complex topic and distill it down to an either-or question.
That's right.
And I mean, if somebody said to you, which is better, golf or giraffes? I don't know. You can't give a meaningful, definitive answer for many, many questions.
Giraffes are better than golf.
Okay. Maybe some people can give a definitive answer. I forgot who.
I'll take a position on it.
Sorry.
I don't know whether that leads to whether referendums would be a good idea or the exact opposite. Again, I'm not sure about that one.
Are you in praise of the don't knows? Do you think that people saying I don't know is a measure actually of intelligence in the face of complex decisions? Well, you yourself said earlier that at that foreign policy forum, you know, you're persuaded, and all of us are like this, by the last, you know, eloquent speaker you heard.
Well, that was the problem of going to a conference like that and hearing a range of different opinions and saying, well, they all sound quite good.
Yeah.
Now I'm not sure. I mean, you could take a stand one way or the other towards Fiji, for example. Now
yes,
I'm not so sure.
You could. So would the world be better off if more people said don't know rather than being shrill on one side or the other?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the Spectator is obviously writing for a certain class of people in England, but whether the government there should go ahead with a referendum on Europe is a really tough question.
Yeah.
Because no one really knows what the outcome is going to be.
Imagine politicians, though, who said, I can't really decide. I'm in a quandary. I know I've thought about it for a while, but I still can't make up my mind.
But this is what you and I were talking about before, Neville, during the break, is if a politician shows anything other than absolute dogmatic conviction in perpetuity, then he's either waffling or U-turning or he can't make his mind up. Whereas the reality is it shows he's actually got a grasp of the nuance of the situation.
Yeah, well, John Key is being blamed for U-turns because he's now backing the railway in the centre of Auckland, the underground one.
Indeed.
And in Christchurch, of course, you've got a whole range of issues there, like should the town hall be saved or the cathedral? And the government went in and they just said, well, we're going to build all these new things, keep the council out. And, oh, by the way, the council, you can sort out whether people really want this or not, and you can pay for it.
It's 14 to 5. A record number of defence staff sought psychological help last year as New Zealand suffered its greatest combat loss since Vietnam. Defence Force stats show the troops assessed for return to New Zealand from Afghanistan went from zero in 2008 to 19 last year. And NZDF was asked but did not detail how many of the 19 people assessed left Afghanistan. The Chief of Defence Staff, gentlemen, says the immediate availability of psychological support can be constrained by the nature of parts of the deployed mission. Which a translation of might be, you know, you'd have to be joking, you're in a Bamiyan village on patrol, so there are no psych services available. It's always been thus, hasn't it, probably, in war?
Well, it's a war. You've got bombs going off around you and bullets whistling past your ears. And they're talking about a health and safety review in the forces. What would that... I mean, I'm a health and safety representative at my school. I know what this involves. What would you look like? Well, you can't possibly go out there. There's bombs and guns and things. It's a battle zone. It's not dangerous. It's not safe. I mean, health and safety legislation says that you should never work in a place where your safety is put at risk. That's a battlefield. Of course it's going to be. And yes, this has been the case all through warfare. We talked about this before. You know, once we call it shell shock, now we call it post-traumatic stress disorder. It's the same thing. If you spend time in that kind of ridiculously stressful, terrifying environment, you are not going to come out of it unscathed. We're human.
Do we have some sort of increasing expectation that war should be bloodless? You know, they're going to try and fight it all with drones now, under the probably illusory expectation that actual people won't ever die in war again.
Well, take a look at any recruitment poster for any... armed services anywhere in the world. New Zealand's going to be guilty of this just as much as any other country. What do you see on the posters? You see the smart uniform, you see the fast planes, you see the machines and the all of... How many people with bullet holes in their heads do you see? How many people with limbs hanging off? That's the reality of war, but we never portray it, do we? That's not going to recruit people. So we portray this as being very clinical, very sanitized, and very nice.
It's interesting, isn't it, that despite the valiant and successful efforts of Sir John Kirwan, admission of psychological frailty is probably still stigmatic in workplaces, so it must take a lot to admit to it in the army.
Especially in the armed forces, I would have thought, yeah, it's not, I mean, you're not a real man if you admit to being scared. I'd be terrified.
Well, presumably it's slowly getting easier and easier, but it's an interesting thing. Does it speak to you at all about the culture of the military, the way this is being run? Because Phil Goff says there's a need to learn lessons about mental health care for troops overseas. Do you think he's probably right?
Well, I'm not quite sure what he's getting at, really, because, as Steve says, this has been the nature of war. Yeah. And so you can't have a soft military. Otherwise, there's no point in having one. It could be that the military has changed dramatically in the role it gives individuals as part of their career or free overseas travel and gets them away from computer games.
I suppose you want to make it as soft or as supportive, as perhaps a better word, as possible until the actual nasty fighting starts. That's probably what they're trying to do.
Yeah, but then at the same time, you can't have soldiers going out on the battlefield, come running in and going, oh, they're shooting at me out there. What did you expect? It's the army.
11 to 5. Now, you or I might think that the collapse of Dave Stewart's garage on the Petone foreshore had something to do with a rare and extreme gale force storm that recently hit Wellington. But if you ask his insurer Tower Insurance, rusty screws were the real culprit. Dave is quoted as being absolutely gobsmacked because Tower Insurance declined his damage claim, potentially leaving him $20,000 out of pocket. And it argued a lack of maintenance, specifically rusty screws, were responsible for the garage's collapse on June the 20 in the deafening gale. And we're going to have Rowan Havelock join us shortly to talk about this. So was it the storm that killed Dave Stewart's garage, or did the screws do it? This is
the
question.
Well, in this case, the insurance company, you've got to have, there's a try on. He's gone to the media. Will he get on to Fair Go? If the insurance company stands firm on Fair Go, they're in the right. But if they give way, they were wrong. But every insurance company will have a go at this, because maintaining a building in a form that is new is quite critical in any insurance policy.
I'm sorry, I can't possibly agree with that. There's a very, very, very simple scientific process to apply to this. We have had, over the period of how many years has this structure been standing? Several, I believe.
A number
of years. Where N is greater than one. It's been up for a while, and it's not fallen down. We change one variable, which is presence or absence of a superstorm, and the thing collapses. There have been, I mean, this is Petone, right? This is Wellington, home of sideways rain. We know it gets windy down there, and this thing hasn't collapsed previously. These screws cannot have been that rusty. They've clearly been doing an adequate job until such time as a superstorm comes blowing through. Insurance companies exist for one purpose, and that is to make money. They don't actually exist to pay money out. They exist to bring money in because they're a business, and that's what they're trying to carry on doing here. They're not in the business of paying money out, and they've seen an opportunity to avoid paying money out. I think they're extraordinarily disingenuous, but that's the reality of the business.
Have Tower Insurance been reading the ACC playbook? Because just as age and bone degeneration, for instance, now disqualifies us, presumably, from being certain of ACC cover if you fall over and bang your knee like you unfortunately mm-hmm. did, Steve. Presumably now age of buildings can disqualify from insurance.
Yeah, well, Steve, there's plenty of incidents where a building has suddenly collapsed without there being a storm because of poor maintenance.
Well, if it suddenly collapses without a storm, you can't say it's because of the presence of a new variable. If a building is happily sitting there and suddenly something finally shears off, gives way, then clearly that was
the
issue.
I've been in some houses where you look at their decks and that sort of thing, and you wouldn't go on top, walk on them.
Quite
because
possibly.
You can see that the nail is rusted right through.
But we're not suggesting that was the case in this gentleman's garage. Well, like I said, Petone, it's part of a notoriously windy area, and this thing was surviving.
I suppose you can argue that because of rust, Neville, something else would have brought it down, just as you can argue that with bone deterioration, you know, you would have received some other sort of injury at some stage rather than the knee injury you got falling down the steps.
Well, the leaky buildings issue is all about, you know, unsafe buildings being eaten away from the inside.
Yeah, well, let's talk to Rowan Havelock.
And maintenance there was pretty slack, apart from the original building itself.
Rowan Havelock's an Auckland barrister and also a lecturer in the University of Auckland Law School, and kindly joining us now. Hello, Rowan.
Yes, hello, Jim. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So this is an interesting point, isn't it? What is the position generally, not necessarily in this particular case, but do you have to, I mean, must we go through life documenting a regular commitment to building maintenance, you know, physical fitness and healthy habits? I mean, that's kind of what we're inferring from all this.
Yes, well, obviously the insurance policy is fundamentally a bargain struck between two parties.
Yes.
And once it's concluded, the insured is bound by its terms, including any exclusion or restriction in relation to maintenance. That's really what the insured's been caught by here. So it's always advisable to sort of actually document your, you know, the fact you're doing maintenance, just so you can meet any sort of claim put forward by the insurer on that basis. But irrespective of that, it's not necessarily the end of the day for the insured here. I mean, there are avenues by which the insured could challenge this decision.
Irrespective of the state of the screws, though, Rowan, it was the storm that brought the building down. That's fairly clear, isn't it?
It seems to be, based on what I've read. I understand that some further investigations are going to be carried out.
Well, let's assume it was. So it didn't just collapse on a fine day because of rusty screws.
Yes. Well, assuming it is the storm that was the operative cause of the damage, and the screws did not contribute to that in any way, then the relevant statute provides that the insured is entitled to prove that it was the storm rather than the screws, and the insurer then cannot decline indemnity.
I understand, but what if the screws did contribute? And to some degree, they were rusty, so it fell down more easily than it would have, a more robust garage would have in a storm.
Then it becomes a question of the exact extent of the contribution of the screws. But if a sort of material contribution can be proved, then the insurer's in trouble.
Okay.
And the insurer might be well within its rights to decline indemnity. Obviously, I haven't seen a particular policy here, so I can't comment on that.
So this is basically in everybody's insurance policy, but the question is, to what extent are we responsible for maintenance and checking everything?
Well, if there is an exclusion in the policy to the effect that there's no indemnity if the insured has not maintained, or if there's been gradual deterioration, then really it's incumbent on the insured to take steps to avoid this kind of situation arising.
But then the insurance companies take your premiums month after month after year without telling you about this. It may be in the original policy. Wouldn't it be fairer if, in fact, there were schedules built in to examine your house to make sure that, in fact, all was tickety-boo?
It would be fairer in terms of actually giving notice to the insured of the relevant term of the policy. I guess there's obviously a difference between what's fair and what the legal result is. It doesn't seem right that an insurer can sort of deny a claim in these sort of circumstances, where, you know, effectively pointing to almost a technicality to decline cover. I completely agree, it doesn't seem fair, but what's fair is one thing, and what the legal result is another, unfortunately.
So it's likely to come down to the rustiness of the screws, the robustness of the rusty screws.
Potentially, if it turns out that the screws did have an effect on the damage, then yes, potentially. But as I said before, if the insured can prove that it was simply the storm that was the operative cause, then they're on safer ground.
Wow. Okay. Thank you very much for joining us on that. I appreciate it. Rowan Havelock on the panel.
You know, it is worth bearing in mind that insurance is one of the very few service industries where there's no presumption that the provider of the service will ever actually have to deliver that service. You know, if you phone for a pizza to be delivered, you pay your money on the assumption the pizza will be there within the half hour. There's no assumption, there's no guarantee that you'll actually get your payment, because there's no guarantee you'll ever make a claim. And so when the time comes for you to make the claim, the insurance company are going to do everything in their power to try and wiggle out.
Steve McCabe, Neville Gibson, one more thing to talk about, and people can read this themselves if they're interested, because we won't have that much time to talk about it, but it's in the Washington Post. Is the internet worth it or not? This is the economics columnist in the Washington Post, Robert Samuelson, suggesting we'd be better off without it. It is the technological marvel of the age, he admits, but it is not, as most people imagine, a symbol of progress. He says it is just the opposite. And he lays down a number of arguments, including the danger of cyber war, the ever more present danger of cyber war as a persuasive argument against the internet. Is the internet more trouble than it's worth?
Well, the deep irony of all of this is that supposedly when the internet was invented all those years ago by Al Gore in his Harvard dorm room with Ricky Lee Jones and Mark Zuckerberg and everyone else was there apparently at the time, the whole point was that this was going to be a technology which was sufficiently distributed that it would be immune to warfare. It was designed by the military to be war-proof. So, yes, we have. But if what this fellow's saying is true, then we're doing it wrong.
Would we really miss it? I'm simplifying everything. People can have a look at everything in between. But Neville, would you? Well, a silly question. Would we miss it? We would now. But would we really be lost without it?
Well, all of the things that are outlined in this article that could be under threat, like hospitals, food distribution, electricity, money, and that sort of thing,
from cyber warfare. Yeah,
yeah. We survived with them before. So I presume we'd just revert back to what we had before. And as he says, all that people would miss is email, Facebook and Twitter, etc.
Yeah, makes
sense. And a lot of people would vote for that, I'm sure.
So you're kind of agreeing with him?
Well, I mean, I know op-ed writers, you want to stir the pot a bit. But I don't think you can actually get rid of the internet. But people probably don't realise until they read this article just how endemic it may be in a whole lot of...
And how vulnerable we are to technological Armageddon.
You know, if you check into a hospital these days, the whole thing is computerised. They know, you know, your records and that sort of thing. They know where you've been.
Exactly.
And the doctor comes to you and all that sort of thing. Things would slow down a lot, wouldn't they?
They'd slow down an enormous amount.
Well, Neville, you and I have managed perfectly well for the last hour without the internet. Jim's clicking away like fury over there, but we're doing okay.
I'm just Googling.
Of course you are.
Very nice to have you both on the panel. Neville Gibson, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Jim.
Steve McCabe, you too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody. Checkpoint follows, and we are back tomorrow.